Before I start, I'd like to welcome people from the Rosicrucian Fellowship who are visiting with us this morning, seeing our church and sharing worship and spiritual time with us. We're glad you're here. We welcome you. Certainly the Rosicrucians and the Swedenborgians share an affinity for wisdom that is not obvious to the eyes and the senses, and we have shared a journey in the mystery for many years. So thank you for being here. Happy Father's Day and happy Juneteenth. It's the day that we celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation. Happy Holy City Day, New Church Day, the day that Swedenborgians celebrate the second coming of Christ in the spiritual understanding of the word. We celebrate the beginning of the descent of the Holy City, New Jerusalem, on June 19th. It's also Trinity Sunday, the Sunday after Pentecost, when the Church of England decided in about the 12th century that we ought to find something very, very churchy, but not too sainty, to celebrate. So it's Trinity Sunday. It's also the Orthodox, Greek and Russian Orthodox, All Saints Day. Is this a special day in the Sweden, in the Rosicrucian calendar in any way? Or do we just share that with everyone, I suppose?
No, not the 19th, but the
The summer solstice is celebrated in many traditions, the Wiccan tradition. This must be a very holy time indeed. Very thin time between the seen world and the unseen world. And the Revised Common Lectionary, the three-year cycle of Bible readings that takes us through the church years, serves up a gospel text that just makes me cringe. I thought the eat my body, drink my blood one was the worst, but this go forth in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit and make disciples of all nations makes me cringe. Don't even get me started about the destruction that has been unleashed on the world in the name of this particular text. Boats by the thousands speeding off to convert South Sea Islanders, people of all nations, Chinese, Japanese, Africans. Boats bringing back Africans as slaves, because after all, we're to make disciples of all the nations, and won't this be effective? And a polarization that pervades today's religious climate between those who proclaim that Christianity is the only way, the truth, the light, and we need to convert everyone, and those who don't sign on to that. I could go on for the whole sermon time, but I'll spare you. And yes, we have Catholic World Service and World Vision and Adventist hospitals and many healing, reconciling efforts on behalf of the church throughout the world. But it will take a lot of Catholic World Service to make up for the Crusades. And even within the Christian charities, there's a lot of debate about should we be out building wells or should we be giving people Bibles? Because after all, that's the ultimate truth. There's a lot of debate even in the non-government organization world about what is Christian mission throughout the world. Are we there to convert souls and to fulfill what's called the Great Commission, to make disciples of all nations? And this text is the first time that the notion of the Trinity is mentioned in the Bible. Jesus doesn't mention it. And Paul, who was the first one to write about Jesus, doesn't mention it. And Mark, which was written before Matthew, also doesn't mention it. But here it is. The Catholic, so be it. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Or in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, depending on whether you're Roman or Orthodox. And the raging theological wars that have gone on through the centuries about this particular concept. I mean, people excommunicated from the church and branded as heretics and new denominations starting and virulent arguments about just how divine was Jesus, just how human was he, and was he of the same substance of God? If he was the Son of God, he had to be made of the same stuff of God. But if he was a human and he was made of this stuff and God isn't made of that stuff, what stuff was Jesus made of? Was it the same stuff or similar stuff? And how could God be God if he had the same stuff? And was the Holy Spirit really stuff or not stuff? And if it was stuff, what kind of stuff? I mean, it went on, and people came out with proclamations, and it flamed for centuries. The Council of Nicaea decreed one edict in 325, and the Council of Toledo decreed another edict in 675, and many, many eye-glazing treatises about the exact nature of the Trinity and how it works and how there can be three but only one and one but there's three. And there's a notion that Swedenborgians don't believe in the Trinity. And this is not actually so. Swedenborg did chime in on that raging debate, which by the 1780s still had not cooled down. And he described the Trinity as the indivisible soul, body, and activity of God. And in Swedenborg's view, if we split the Trinity into a Father that's God, and a Son that is Jesus, and a Holy Spirit, each of these elements standing on their own, if we split the Trinity up that way, we split ourselves. We split our own consciousness. For Swedenborg, the Trinity was about wholeness, and unity and connection and a dynamic interplay between God as a soul, a manifestation, a body, and activity, and ourselves as a soul, a body, and the activity of our lives. And Professor Inez Radsens over at SHS observes that the splitting of the Trinity has created a lot of denominations that overemphasize one role or the other, one part of the Trinity or another, that it kind of corrupted the body, soul, and activity of the church, if you will, to have denominations that focus in the extreme on one particular element of the Trinity. If we were evangelical, today would be all about focusing on Jesus and what Jesus told us and converting people to Jesus' way of thinking. If we were Pentecostal, it would be the work of the Holy Spirit. It would be trying to invoke the Holy Spirit into our presence and trying to follow what the Holy Spirit is doing and telling us to do. And last week, Pentecost would have been our high holy day. Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox worship Mary. They venerate the Mother of God. You see icons in the Russian church and the Greek church of, you know, the beautiful commanding presence of Mary, and there's a little sort of baby that somebody kind of painted as an afterthought over here, and there she is. And if we wanted to find God, simply God, nothing but God, we'd have to find a synagogue or a mosque. I thought maybe in some ways the Trinity was another way. It was the debates about it kind of going on hundreds of years after Jesus taught and ministered. It was another way to differentiate ourselves from the Jewish tradition that Jesus came from, was to bring the notion of the Trinity in. So I picked the picture that's on your bulletin today, which is this. It's hard to see from there, because I think it expresses Swedenborg's understanding of the Trinity better than any explanation. God knows the last thing we need is another explanation of the Trinity, so I will spare you that. Einstein says, if we trace out what we behold and experience through the language of logic, which is how most Trinitarian arguments have been presented, we are doing science. If we show it in forms whose interrelationships are not accessible to our conscious thought, but are instinctively recognized as meaningful, we are doing art. So this picture does just that, and I'll put this up. This gold one it was painted on Mount Athos. I'll put this up at coffee hour so people can kind of absorb it. I think this image of the Trinity shows the Trinity in forms whose interrelationships are not accessible to our conscious thought, but are instinctively recognized as meaningful. This is a 15th century Russian icon that was painted to express the unexplainable. And it is actually a picture of the three angels who visited Abraham, in whom Abraham honors God's unbelievable covenant, and he offers hospitality. So these, the three figures in this particular icon are those figures that in the Genesis passage from today, the three angels or men or manifestations of God that appeared to Abraham right after God had told Abraham that he would indeed bring forth a child. And these three people appear, and Abraham gives them hospitality, pure and simple. And I've always loved this icon because I feel it expresses the Trinity in our own experience. It's relational. It's connected. You know, you sort of see the way the feet kind of and the heads and the gaze, they're all focused on this nourishing hospitality. All of the elements are interrelated and dynamically connected. They're not arranged in a hierarchy of God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit wafting among us. None can be separated from the others. You couldn't just take one out and have the picture stand on its own. John and I were looking at another picture of the Trinity that had three kind of separate and distinct figures, but each had its own individuality, and you could pull one out and the other two would still be there. But this, they're all tied up together. It's tender. It's humble. You're not quite sure whether the figures are men or women or angels. I find it very accessible. You know, it's earthly yet heavenly. Lover, beloved, love itself. United by this central element of hospitality, of welcoming, of inviting. So there's something that this picture, this lovely icon, shows that I just can't explain. So according to Matthew, Jesus' last words to us, known as the Great Commission, are to go forth into the world, making disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit that came to us at Pentecost. Well, like any decent preacher, I set about researching this text, looking at what had been said about it, looking into the history, what was there. And some translations say, go make disciples of all nations. Some translations say, go and teach all nations. I thought, well, that's kind of... is it make disciples of or teach? I wonder what the Greek word is. So I'm just back from Greece, and I'm able to competently read a menu well enough to not order guts and brains. So I went to my trusty Greek dictionary and looked up the word that was there and was absolutely hit between the eyes. The root of the Greek verb that's translated either as make disciples of or teach, this one Greek verb that launched 1,000 missionary ships, is the root of it is mathete, like mathematics, and it literally means to learn by inquiry, to understand, to ask about, to find out about. Well, why didn't you say so? It's not, the Greek word is not didaskon, or as in didactic, which Matthew uses earlier, as in Jesus went about all Galilee teaching in the synagogues. He uses a different word for that, a word that's related to the word didactic. The disciples were literally students. They were people learning. They were people inquiring. They were not necessarily believer, follower, converts. And it made me think about how Jesus taught and how he made disciples, how he went forth into the world teaching and making disciples of people. How did he do that? With stories and images, parables, with love and compassion, simply by being this presence that transformed people's lives, just by being who he was. He taught by being, not by explaining. And another important element in the Greek worldview through which Jesus' Jewish thought entered the Western world, kind of a, you know, the worldview, the way people thought about things, the way people were educated, the way people learned before there were lots of books, before there was Kindle, the way people learned things was heavily influenced by the Socratic method. Socrates, old, all I know is that I know nothing, the gadfly of Athens, he used a system of questioning that was designed to not to lead somebody to a particular conclusion or to get them to think or believe something, but to uncover the assumptions that they were bringing to the table in their exploration of a moral issue or an ethical issue or a spiritual issue or a philosophical thought. It was led to kind of question you until you uncovered the assumptions and the unfounded bases of thought, the blind spots we all have in our thinking, the things we kind of take for granted or take for given when we explore what we consider to be a particular truth. Socratic questioning, like Jesus' teaching, like the way Jesus taught and like many of his parables, guides the student, guides the disciple, and engages their own natural curiosity and longing for insight. So it doesn't, and we often biblical lessons, we look at the Bible as if it were a moral lesson or here's what you do or what you don't do, when often Jesus' teachings were very ambiguous and it led you to question your own assumptions, your own insight, your own thoughts about how things are and how you saw things. Now, of course, Socrates was so irritating that they made him kill himself. You can well imagine how annoying it would be to have someone around you questioning your assumptions all of the time. But it's worth considering as a line of thought. You know, we want to know what is the truth. You know, tell me what to go forth with or what to believe. And Socratic questioning and Jesus' teaching and the way he made disciples was more about engaging our own natural curiosity and our own longing for insight, and kind of engaging that in an active and dynamic way. So what does it mean to go forth inquiring about all nations? To go forth into the world learning about all nations? To go into the world as open and humble, as connected as this Trinity icon, simply with a spirit of inquiry and the assumption that what you know is nothing. Really, it affected me to think about that and wonder about that question. I mean, I go forth in a spirit of goal-directed accomplishment. I go forth in a spirit of what is good, what is bad, how I do want things to be, how I don't want things to be, how things should be, how they should not be. I go forth in a mission-driven spirit of compassion, determined to be a blessing. I go forth to find out things, to resolve, to assess. You know, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to figure out the answer to this question. I even go forth in a spirit of hope from time to time, or a spirit of joy. I'm going to spread joy. So this call just simply to go forth in an open spirit of inquiry. What if? What about? Why? What? Has really had an impact on me. What would this look like? I mean, how does someone going forth to understand react to people of different belief systems, different faiths, different cultures, people who do things differently? Going into the world to ask, to inquire about, to understand. What does that mean? How does that change? I don't know. I don't have the answer. I'm asking like Socrates. It's kind of a continual question. How does that impact people that I have difficulty with or people I'm in conflict with? And I thought, what about my own inner nations? You know, what about my inner spiritual landscape? What about the nations within me, the countries of my heart? The landscape that includes our spiritual deserts and our dismal back alleys, as well as our psychic fertile valleys. How do we go forth into that with a spirit of inquiry? How do we treat our inner nations, our inner peoples, like Jesus treated his disciples, and not like missionaries treated First Nations peoples around the world? It's an interesting consideration. Go forth with a spirit of inquiry, learning about and understanding all nations and all peoples, seeing them as sacred in the name of the dynamic, unified relationality of all life. Now that's a commission.